Hi, everybody. Hope you're all staying safe and quarantined. Pete and I are here temporarily breaking quarantine, but following all of the right cleaning protocols.
Yes.
And we're going to make a couple podcasts each week. First, we're going to make a podcast where we talk about some of our favorite moments in the chapter that we read for this week. And then, and we'll give that to you right away. And then we'll do some discussion questions on the forums, on Blackboard, during the week. And then after those have closed, you'll get another podcast where we sort of go through the questions sort of with our answers to those questions. We'll work that way. Then we'll have two podcasts bookending the week and then discussion questions that where you'll be interacting with each other on the forums during the week.
Yeah. Does
that sound right?
Yep, that's what we have.
Cool. So, to kick us off, I'm just going to ask Pete what was one of his favorite moments in this chapter, The Thing in the Natural World, from, of course, Merleau-Ponty's Phenomenology of Perception. So.
Yeah. So I was struck, like I have been in a lot of other instances, with those places where Merleau-Ponty brings in the affect or the emotional. In the perception of objects, in some really interesting ways. And so the one that really stuck out to me this time was this bouquet of flowers,
yeah,
which he talks about on page 335 in that section. The thing is not necessarily an object. So I'll just read from it a little bit and then talk about it some, because it's just pretty wonderful. So, it says, everything that makes up a part of my environment is perceived. And my environment includes everything with whose existence or absence, with whose being so or other than so, I practically reckon. And that's a quote he's taking from someone else. But then he continues, the storm that has not yet broken, whose signs I could not even list, and that I do not even foresee, but for which I am equipped and prepared. The periphery of the visual field that the hysteric does not explicitly grasp, but that nevertheless co-determines his movement and his orientation. This is where it gets really beautiful. The respect for other men, or that loyal friendship that I no longer even noticed, but that were nevertheless present for me since, when they are withdrawn, I am left off balance. And so love is in the bouquet, right? That Felix de Vandenesse prepares for Madame de Motzoff. And he says, as I pick the flowers, and he gives us that really great section there. And then he continues, it is evident the bouquet is a bouquet of love, and yet it is impossible to say what in the bouquet signifies love.
Yeah.
And this is precisely why Madame de Motzoff can accept it without violating her vows.
Yeah.
The way of understanding the bouquet is by looking at it, but then it says what it means.
Mm.
Its signification is the trace of an existence legible and comprehensible for another existence, and thus natural perception is not a science. It does not posit the things upon which it bears, and it does not step back from them in order to observe them. Rather, it lives among them and is the opinion or the originary faith that ties us to a world as if to our homeland. The being of the perceived is the pre-predicative being toward which our total existence is polarized. I like this idea a whole lot of existence or absence,
mm-hmm,
right? That to me is so, it's like the other side of the, you know, of the object that we perceive. We know, mm-hmm, that it's there without making explicit that it's there.
Mm-hmm.
And the constitution of the thing is only constituted by its absence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so there would be bouquets that you could give someone that did not,
right,
signify love.
Yep.
And so they were defined in a way by their by the absence of love in them.
Yes.
And you would know, oh, this is just a friendship, friendly bouquet.
Right.
This is just a, hey, how are you doing? Hey, I hope you feel just better soon.
Here's some flowers.
Right.
Good to see
you. Yeah.
Good to see you.
Yeah, it's interesting, yeah, how without the person even giving you a message, there's something even in the selection of the flowers. Like, you know, I actually had this experience.
Someone gave you
No.
You gave someone flowers.
Yeah, when I was in my 20s, I gave one of my very close friends some flowers, some very strange flowers. They're ginger flowers, which are weird looking if you ever see them. And they're not common. And it was some ginger flowers and then some other things together in a bouquet. And we'd been good friends for a long time, but like I was definitely signaling something by giving her this bouquet, and she knew it immediately when she saw them, and it was like it was pretty awkward because I think we were not going to end up dating. Yeah. We were going to stay friends, but there was this crucial moment because I did not say anything. I didn't say, "Here is a bouquet of love." Yeah. She just looked at the flowers and she looked at me giving them to her, and it was like, "Wait, something's up."
Yeah, it's a situation.
Yeah, the situation.
And it's also, so it's not exclusively, it is in the object.
Yeah, it is in the object.
Yeah.
Like, it was in those, the ginger flowers were very, like,
yeah.
It's like, I mean, a more obvious example, I guess, would be like if you had a, you know, a close friend, you know, that you're not dating, but you gave them like a dozen roses on their birthday.
Yeah.
And they'd be like,
"Oh, that's weird.
What the?
What is that? What is
Why
that?
Did you give me a dozen roses on my birthday?"
Yeah.
And you'd be like, "I don't know. Oh, you're really special." And I was like, "Whoa.
Yeah. It's in the, it is in the object, the sense making of it."
Yeah.
In that sense, there could be a certain presence that suggests an absence. It's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
I love that he says it's impossible to say what in the bouquet signifies love.
Right. I mean, it's maybe...
It's on the way, right, toward that constant thing that he has about this sort of always unfinished, ever not quite, always in the making, you know what I mean? Sort of thing about it, that we know that it's there without explicitly saying so.
Yeah.
And so the experience of the thing, of the bouquet itself, it's just laden.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? With all of these things.
Because it's that unnameable thing that's in the bouquet.
Yeah.
That we're trying to aim at with a word like love. But even our words are like aiming at these primordial significations in the things themselves.
Right.
That like
So you wouldn't
are
say
richer than the words.
So you wouldn't say it symbolizes
love. It doesn't just symbolize.
No, because then what you're separating is object, bouquet of flowers, right? From something signification
meaning.
Or meaning.
Yeah.
Right? When
To others,
some kind. And you're making all the same kinds of mistakes.
Yeah. Right? That's right. You're separating, by separating the object and the meaning, you're sort of turning the object into something empirical.
Yeah.
And the meaning into something intellectual.
Yeah.
Right, so you're sort of doing the classic,
empiricist
intellectualist split.
Yeah,
but
it has nothing to do with when you gave that person ginger flowers.
Yeah,
right. What that was like.
Right. It was it was something that was where we were both, like, in the soup.
You were in it.
Yeah, yeah. We were in something that you can only make sound like it has different parts when you're outside of it.
Yeah.
So like you can look. I mean, yes, we can say that roses symbolize romantic stuff because of how many, because of just how heavy-handed that signification has become in our culture.
Right? Sure.
But, you know, I think that's why it's more interesting when it's not, say, a bouquet of roses. I don't think that this bouquet that he's referring to
is just flowers.
It's just flowers, right? Yeah. And, you know, how would you know? But you know.
Yeah.
And that's the thing, is there, if we think about some of those experiences we've had in life, where how would you know that it had the emotional meaning that it had? You couldn't describe how you possibly know that, but you know it.
You just know.
And and it's there.
Yeah.
And these things are known from being inside the situation. So all of the intellectual work we do to separate ourselves from the situations in order to understand them is like taking out the very thing we're trying to understand, which is what it's like to be in.
Right.
A world with things.
Yeah.
Not what it's like to dissect a world with things into abstractions. That wasn't our original question.
Yeah.
Originally, we wanted to know, what is this world that we're in? And then we tried to answer it through the empirical and the intellectualist accounts, which immediately like took us away from the very thing that we were trying to understand. Mm-hmm. It's a lot like, you know, when you want to understand the life of an animal and then you kill it and dissect it on a table. Mm-hmm. You've gotten rid of the very thing you were trying to understand in the moment that you tried to dissect it.
Yeah.
So.
And we'll see more about that, I think, once we get to like the hallucinations.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
Because that's the thing. We want to construct, right? Yeah. Or dissect, right? Rather than understand.
Yeah, exactly. We want to construct rather than be in.
Be in.
The world.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because being in things means ambiguity. Yeah. It means confusion. It means equivocation. It means all of these things.
So are you still friends with this
young
lady?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. She's still a friend of mine. We weren't friends for a while. Not because of that. Separate thing. But I actually just saw her last
different
year.
Gift.
Yeah. 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 I tried this a number of times.
Terrible.
No, no. But I
here's a block plane. You know?
Yeah. We were friends when I was in Philadelphia in grad school, and I actually just saw her last year.
Yeah.
She's doing well.
Good.
Yeah. Do you ever give anybody flowers? I mean, you've been with your wife for forever.
Yeah.
So. Since you were 20.
Yeah, 20, I don't know, 24, 25, something like that.
Yeah, for a long time.
Yeah, a long time.
Did you ever, never give
I've given the worst gifts, many kids.
Good.
Yeah. And so she's left with, we've been left with strange experiences.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, I mean, where you're trying to figure out, what does this
mean? What does that mean?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, how about you, Andy? Did you have one?
a favorite moment?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Funny through. That you ask that.
Well, what do you think?
I was pretty struck by the way Merleau-Ponty took up this, what he's been calling the paradox of immanence and transcendence. In this book, and on page 339 at the bottom.
Oh, I had that too.
Yeah, he says, how might we simultaneously understand that the thing is the correlate of my knowing body and that the thing denies this body?
Yeah.
So I think that's really interesting because he's trying to talk about how the structure, I mean, we've talked a lot in this class about open-endedness and ambiguity of the world, because that's been the main theme.
Yeah.
But here, he's beginning to give us some more concrete ways of understanding how that openness got open.
Yeah.
How the opening was made. Mm-hmm. And the opening is made by a simultaneous movement of involvement in and kind of repulsion from things. And what I think he's going to come to really identify this dialectical movement that both involves us in and sort of repulses us from the things.
Yeah.
He's gonna eventually, I think, describe this as what he calls time. I think the word time is going to start signifying the sort of movement by which the open-endedness of the world is made open. And
because it requires that non-human, anonymous right, feature of it in order for it to become clear to us. The way that we know that ultimately I'm interacting with this something that is not me.
Yeah.
And yet I am in it,
yeah.
Right, at the same time. And it's why he saves himself from all the, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
All the sort of, you could just take this down to the garden path, to the kind of total subjectivity.
Right.
Where it would be, it would be just a kind of solipsism where, you know, you sort of think it's all me or, you know.
That, and that would be if the thing was just the correlate to my knowing body.
Yeah.
If the thing was just the correlate to my knowing body, that's subjectivity.
Yeah, totally. That's all subjectivism. The way down to the ground. Yeah,
right.
All
that means down to the ground. We construct a world based on our own private experiences.
Because the moment here is the critical movement to me that really fills that out too. Is, you know, we've only gone this far and we've talked about the psychological, the different subjective states of consciousness, but we can't stop there. Mm-hmm. We have to get radical. You know what I mean? And that getting radical requires that we get to that point where we talk about, you know, the thing that is not me.
Yeah.
You know?
Right. That's right. That's what I think what's so exciting about this chapter is that it's more ontological, we could say, than the chapter so far, which is just meaning he's going deeper and trying to describe, like, what those experiences of perception indicate about the actual being of the things perceived. And he's indicating that their being is itself not only is perception of them open-ended, but their very being is an open-ended structure because it's fundamentally temporal. And it's that temporal structure that means that we're always both are both in the things and have access to them, and also never have enough access to say that we know them fully, completely, or absolutely.
Because we couldn't be in time if there weren't an always coming up.
Right. It's not possible to have temporal experience that's complete.
Yep.
The nature of temporal experience is to be inherently ecstatic.
Yeah.
Right?
That's right.
Or to be imminently unbounded or something like that.
Well, that's why that when he makes that really great wicked move where he, you know, where he says that a notion of a kind of eternal present,
right,
a bounded eternal present would just be death.
Yeah. Yeah. That's right. It would just be death.
Because then we wouldn't be in time.
That's right.
So much for Augustine.
Yeah, so much for Augustine's idea.
Oh, God.
Yeah. Like, on page 346, he says, there is indeed a contradiction. Right? Now he's talking back about this, I mean, the contradiction that I've been talking about, this contradiction between between the completeness and the incompleteness of the world, or between being... the paradox of immanence and transcendence, being in things, but somehow the things are always like running away from us.
Yes.
As if they didn't want us to get to know them.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Chasing it.
Yeah.
We're thrown in and then we're chasing. Yeah.
Says, there is indeed a contradiction.
Yeah.
So long as we are operating within being. Yeah. But the contradiction ceases, or rather is generalized. It becomes linked to the ultimate conditions of our experience, and it merges with the possibility of living and thinking if we operate within time.
There it is,
Because what he's suggesting is that in the history of philosophy, we have worked from this abstract idea that we could study the world in a kind of frozen moment. Mm-hmm. That we could just, like, stop. With a camera. We could just, like, take a snapshot of everything where it is right now.
Which takes us back to the problem of motion as being a successive series of instants.
Right.
That you could somehow isolate.
Right.
Which defeats the notion of motion itself and defeats the notion of time, because motion is time.
And now we think about that throwing the rock. And, like, obviously the rock can't, like, be in each of those. It's not just like it's like completely clear.
Each of those excessive, clear, freeze-framed, you know.
What it is the rock is blurry because the rock, even when it was just sitting there, was to some degree blurry.
Yeah.
We've never had perfect perception of anything, and we never will.
Nope.
And that's what guarantees that we can have any perception at all.
Yep.
And so he says, if we operate within time, and if we succeed in understanding time as the measure of
a being.
Instead of trying to see time as some kind of being is the ultimate standard, like some kind of eternal presence or eternal being. That's truth. And time is some kind of messed up way that we're forced to sort of live an inauthentic or like partial version of what God might have, you know, in full or something like that.
Right.
You know, that's not, it that doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
The synthesis of horizons is essentially temporal. That is, it is not subjected to time. It does not suffer time. And it does not have to overcome time, right? It doesn't have to overcome it because it is it.
It is it.
Yeah. Right?
He says it merges with.
It merges with the very movement by which time goes by.
Yeah.
Though my perceptual field, or through my perceptual field with its spatial horizons, I am present to my surroundings. I coexist with the other landscapes that extend beyond. And all these perspectives together form a single temporal wave, an instant of the world.
I love the wave.
Yeah, the temporal wave. It's great. Because he's saying that the goal of an analysis of perception is not to figure out what the world would be like without time, as if that were the truth. Instead, the goal is to understand what it is like in time.
Yeah.
And that means that we're trying to, in a way, we're finally admitting that the incompleteness isn't a problem. The incompleteness is the condition for the possibility of experience happening at all.
Yeah.
And so he's just been, he does so many different things with size and color and with reality and with hallucinations and with things throughout this chapter. Well,
that's why if we go back through it, that's why the absence is so important.
Right.
Right. Because the absence that is in the thing.
Right.
Right. Is because it's in time.
Right. Yes.
You see what I mean? That's the only way that the absence of the thing.
Everything is always partial. Yeah. And everything is always the presence of an absence is at the same time that it's the presence.
My experience of the landscape is the absence of the other distant landscapes that make up the notion of having a landscape.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right, right, right. Like when he talks about the hill and how there are more, there's another landscape behind the hill.
Yeah.
And then there's another landscape behind that.
Yeah.
And then there's the sea behind that.
Yeah.
And then there's like, you know, you can imagine, you can do that.
Yeah.
You can like look out of your window. Wherever you are, Indiana, Ohio, Texas, wherever you are, you can look out your window and you can imagine your way all the way to China.
Yep.
Where this whole coronavirus business started. you can't actually do it.
Yeah.
Like you couldn't, it wouldn't be detailed.
No.
It wouldn't be a very good rendering.
No.
But you know that it's out there when you look out the window and that whatever's blocking your view, you know that there are things behind the things behind the things behind the things behind the things and so on.
Yeah.
And
if you just live in that imagined place, well, that's not nearly as robust as the sense of the now, you know, within which we're already thrown.
Yeah.
But it's there.
Right. It's there as an absence.
Yeah, it's there as an absence on the other side of it.
Right.
Like to be explicit about it is to imagine it, you know, but it's there.
Yeah. So like when I look out my window and I see that house there with the red roof.
Right.
I, in a weird way, I know that behind that is China somewhere.
Yeah.
I never make that explicit to myself. This is the first time I've ever done that.
Yeah.
But in a way it's implied.
Yeah.
In a way the whole rest of the world is implied by the presence of that house.
Right.
Blocking the view. Yeah. The horizon means, and this is, again, the horizon has been such an important metaphor in this book.
It has.
The horizon means there's something beyond the horizon.
Mm-hmm. It's that's the horizon of horizons.
Yes.
As he puts it, right?
Yeah. It's the horizoning.
Yeah, it's the horizoning.
Yeah. 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 So
that's good stuff.
Yeah. He's doing such a nice job trying to put words to something that is so hard to talk about.
Yeah, it really is.
Because again, as we saw in I think the passage you read, we're trying to get to this idea of the originary faith that ties us to a world, as if to our homeland. That was on page 336.
Yeah,
that originary faith that ties us to the world as if to our homeland is this weird way that we know we're part of the thing that we're in. And even when there are problems that cause doubts, or we have illusions or other kinds of hallucinations or anything, those are all just ways of confirming this originary faith in the world, not actually undermining it.
Mm-hmm.
So this chapter, I think, really begins to make that originary faith more explicit.
Yeah. And we don't need to see the contradiction as necessarily a fatal contradiction.
No, it's not a fatal contradiction at all.
It's the only way that we can
have... It's the only way that it could happen.
A reality.
Right. Yeah. It's just like if you thought that it was a contradiction that time had both past and future.
Yeah.
If you were like, but how could something have both opposites? Yeah. Past is the opposite of future. Future is the opposite of past. This thing you call time has both past and future. Those are opposites. It can't be.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
We all know that, like, of course the structure of time is that it has past and future. Mm-hmm. That's exactly what time is.
Yeah.
Is the way in which the present opens simultaneously onto the past and the future.
Yeah.
It's only a contradiction from a sort of narrow point of view.
Yeah.
So I think they're going to have a lot of fun reading this chapter.
I think so too.
Because you and I did.
Because we had a great time.
But boy, it took me all week.
Yeah.
But Pete hammered this thing out in what, five hours? 5 hours this morning.
But it was intense study.
Yeah, it was 6 hours.
Yeah.
It was just. You didn't take breaks. No. And you drank a lot of coffee.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Whereas I did this, I think, I did this in probably 6 1-hour sections over the course of a week.
Yeah.
And
I'm not going to do that again.
You're not going to do that? You're not, yeah.
But I feel like I'm a better person.
Yeah.
Because I did it.
You know? Yeah. Yeah. And I would say, you know, that... Yeah, it just takes that. The reading is a good 50 pages or so.
Yeah.
And it's...
I mean, if you think about it, that puts me at, what, less than 10 pages an hour.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's what I found.
You know what I mean? That's...
My normal reading rate, I would say, is 3 minutes per page.
Yeah.
For philosophy, it often is about 6 minutes per page, which is double.
Yeah.
And so that's about what it takes
10
me.
10 minutes. It's 10 pages an hour.
Yep, 10 pages an hour.
Yeah.
I've noticed my reading pace throughout the semester, and that's about what I'm able to do.
Yeah.
Is 10 an hour. But I have to be focused.
Yeah.
If I don't focus,
really focus,
it'll take me 2 hours to do 10 pages.
I have to be in it.
Yeah.
Otherwise. Yeah.
And if I go any faster than that, I feel like I don't actually get.
I agree.
Get it.
Yeah.
So
there you go.
Yeah.
Them's the breaks.
Yeah, that's our experience.
Yeah.
So yeah, hopefully you guys find some form of fun with this chapter.
We had a lot of fun.
There's a lot of neat stuff, especially in the beginning. I think you guys will like the stuff about size and color.
The stuff at the end about hallucinations.
Oh, it's beautiful.
It's really gorgeous stuff.
Yeah.
So I think that's there's great. Plenty.
There's plenty to get excited
about.
There's
lots to chew on in this one.
All right, and we will send you another podcast at the end of the week that deals with specific answers to the questions that you'll be dealing with over the week. All right, bye, stay safe.